Welcome to episode 62 of the Ball Chats podcast. And we are sadly going to be without our main host, Andy Bissett, tonight. He's got some kind of homoerotic East Coast pleasure beach thing going on with one of his friends, so he can't make it with us today, but he will be sorely missed. But in his absence, we're going to be talking about the FA Cup semi-final results. We're going to be talking about the battles at each end of the table. There's been a lot of developments for all the teams involved there. A lot of teams with a lot to play for so far, and they're all scrapping it out, upturning the form book, left, right, and centre. We have the top five things that you may have missed. A distinctly slow-cooked Moroccan-style dish from Flynn this week that I'm very much looking forward to. And finally, a bumper combat sports section with cards from pretty much every top MMA organisation on the planet coming up this weekend. We'll cover the results from last week as well before we get to the big one this Saturday. It's the return of the Gypsy King, Tyson Fury, as he defends his WBC and ring heavyweight titles against the man they call the body snatcher, i.e. Mr. You're talking rubbish, Dillian White. It's going to be sick. Flynn, how are you doing, man? You've just got off work. How are you feeling about being on a captainless ship this week in Bissett's absence?
I'm feeling good. I'm feeling confident. I don't know, this might be the best one yet.
I mean, I've had a funny feeling that might be the case.
He's been holding us back for too long. Yeah, but I mean, whenever do we get to speak about the real sports that the people want to know about? Bodybuilding, WWE, balloons.
Yeah, I think the hot air balloon game has really developed in the last 5 years, and I just want to give it the attention it deserves. But basically, we are going to miss you. And on that note, we'll start the preamble ramble. Now, as you and I both know, Flynn, today, April 21st, 2022, marks the 20-year anniversary of Hulk Hogan beating Triple H for the WWE Undisputed Championship at Backlash 2002.
Alhamdulillah.
He'd left the company in 1993, a few years after the true cultural phenomenon that was Hulkamania had stopped running wild, brother. He was probably limping along by that point, to be honest. But he left for WCW, where he and two other defectors, Scott Hall and Kevin Nash, formed the New World Order. And under the direction of WCW president Eric Bischoff, this sparked a cross-promotional rivalry that would become known as the Monday Night Wars. Raw versus Nitro, ratings versus ratings, live every Monday night. WCW would later fall into decline. WWE would purchase them, absorb their talent, which tempted Hulk Hogan and the NWO to sign as well. And it didn't take long before they turned him back into the red and yellow icon, the WWE version of Hollywood Hulk Hogan. And this victory cemented him again as the top man in the organization. After being at the epicenter of pro wrestling for two decades, he still had enough post-Attitude era to be given a run at the top. Now, Flynn, what are your memories of the great man, possibly one of the greatest sportsmen in history?
For sure, one of the greatest men in sports history. Now, look, as you and I are both avid Hulkamaniacs, Bissett included, probably the biggest Hulkamaniac out of the three of us. What's it to say about this man? What hasn't he done? The guy's been center stage of sports entertainment for decades. Champion, I don't know how many times. We'll get some stats up about the man himself, man. 20 years, so it's the 20th anniversary today when he beat Triple H for the WWE title.
Yeah, for the undisputed title that Chris Jericho had united WCW and WWE heavyweight championships just a couple of months before. And Triple H obviously took him away from him at WrestleMania. I think it was 2002. No, WrestleMania 18. Yeah, see, the memory's killing it, man.
Chris Jericho, to this day, does not shut up about being the first undisputed champion.
I mean, would you? I wouldn't.
Yeah. But so I remember when he won that. Didn't he beat Stone Cold and The Rock to unify them belts?
On the same night, mate.
Mate. Those are the days.
I don't even think Tyson Fury will be able to do that, to be honest with you.
Jericho would batter Fury, and we all know it.
Yeah, definitely. I mean, skill for skill, maybe Tyson Fury would like out jab him for a couple of rounds, but it's only a matter of time before he drops a little lion salt on your head. What was the Jericho style?
He'd be tapping. He'd be crying for his mum tapping, son.
Listen, if you're listening to this a couple of days from now and we're ruining your coastal drive with your friend, there's a lot more to come. So buckle up, mate. And
but let's just go back to Hulk Hogan just for a second. So he won that title, the undisputed title, from Triple H 20 years ago. He was 48 when he won that.
Mate, that's
the
nothing.
Athleticism.
And he'd had, I think, 2 or 3 knee replacements up to that point. Right, he'd been out of the game, not even active. I mean, Muhammad Ali spent 3 years out of the ring. I think we could probably liken the absence from when he left WCW to joining WWE to that kind of achievement. I don't want to overstate it, but I think that's a pretty fair comparison.
I don't see anyone else in combat sports winning belts at 48. So, GOAT.
I mean, is there any question? I would definitely say so. The all-time 100%. GOAT. Anderson Silva ain't got shit on Hulk Hogan. That's what I'm saying.
GSP, Silver, Fury, Ali, Tyson, the lot of them.
I mean, just on size alone, I think he'd manhandle Khabib, to be honest with you.
Oh, I heard he trained him.
Yeah.
He taught him all he knows.
Yeah, man. He's got. I reckon now he's still got a couple of secrets. You know, the student never really becomes the master, does he? So,
mate, where do you think? Why do you think he keeps saying brother all the time?
Oh my god. Oh, that is joke.
That's right, brother. Hulkamania's are running wild, brother.
Oh, and he was in Gremlins 2 as well. Come on. And Three Ninjas, High Noon at Mega Mountain, the classic. I think it was like 97.
That's the one. Yeah. Is that the one where he tries to save the little girl's cat from a tree and he pulls the tree down and the little girl goes, "That's not my cat." And he lets go of the tree and the cat just catapults, launches up the tree, goes flying.
And famously, no special effects used in that movie.
All right, so it's probably the right time to announce to the fans that we're pivoting the whole podcast. It's now called Hulkamaniacs United.
Yeah,
we just strictly talk about wrestling and mainly Hulk Hogan.
Yeah, we just got the licensing agreement this morning. Cost a pretty penny, let me tell you. And we're just going to crack on from here. Long live the king, who was also in Rocky 3 as well. I mean, the accolades, do they stop? He was Thunderlips in Rocky 3, legit, man. Just, it doesn't stop, so... But we'll let Bissett's heart rate drop for a couple of minutes and we will soothingly move on to the footy chat for this week. And as I said at the top of the show, there has been a lot going on. We'll start with the FA Cup semi-finals from last weekend. Liverpool ran riot on Man City last Saturday. The game ended 3-2, but to be honest with you, Liverpool battered them. It was Konate with a header from a corner in the first half. Basically looking like the kid who'd been kept back 5 years at school, just bullying lads in the air. And Mane scored the second, rushed the keeper for his first goal. Stefan, the keeper for City, took a very casual touch on the line and they paid the price. And Mane's second goal was just sick. Like, Liverpool played through them like they weren't even there. Thiago dinked a little cross out to Mane near the corner of the box and he just sliced it into the bottom corner with his first touch. They were super casual but intense at the same time. Grealish and Bernardo Silva managed to get the scoreline to be somewhat respectable late on. And both of those goals were the result of Riyad Mahrez breaking down the right-hand side and cutting in. And we've covered in the past Pep Guardiola's tendency to make unexpected little tweaks to his lineups on the eve of big games. And I think he made one in this game as well. Mahrez, their top scorer, omitted from the opening lineup in the place of a man, Gabriel Jesus, who usually plays up top. People look to him like he's probably the only proper striker, traditionally speaking. They started him out on the right with Sterling starting up top. He usually goes out on the left. So a lot of messing about with the attacking lineup. And as soon as Mahrez came on, he just started making things happen. And I think it's fair to speculate that had he started the game, they would have been more potent going forward. And I think Pep might have made a bit of a miscalculation on that one.
It seems now he's done that twice on the trot and it hasn't worked out either time. And I know we talked about it with Bissett last time, but what's his plan? Is he trying to make it difficult for his opponents to guess what he's going to do? But it just seems like a bit of an unnecessary risk because they're sick. how they are normally. What do you make of that?
Because they're competing on so many fronts, it's inevitable that you're not going to be able to play the same players in the same positions week in, week out, for various reasons like energy levels, injuries, perhaps different tactical requirements of the team you're about to face. The Man City and Liverpool, if they don't already, by the end of this season, they're going to know each other very well indeed, the amount of times they've played each other. And I think they're quite particular circumstances. So I think the other famous example that we've talked about is last year's Champions League final, where he, when he omitted Fernandinho from the starting lineup in the centre of midfield. And Fernandinho had been playing sick. Like, he's the guy that mops everything up and gives a little pass to the sick players who can break forward and do their creative stuff. So he's like a functional player. But Pep chose not to go with him. I think he started Gundogan there, who'd been playing further up. So it does seem to me from the outside that he might be overthinking it, but he might have also identified something in Liverpool's lineup, a tendency of the past few weeks or months that he could exploit by putting Jesus down the right and Sterling up top. Maybe he had the perfect plan and the players on the day just didn't execute. But to be honest, Liverpool just looked superior, like one-on-one. They looked like they could have scored a lot more goals if Man City's rebuttal had been stronger earlier on in the game, because their two goals were, they scored the first one quite early on in the second half. And you think, all right, we've got a game on here. Then Liverpool just threw a wet blanket over them, just like, ease up, kids, you're not having this. And then they scored at the end, but by then the threat was already over. So yeah, Liverpool looking dominant. Bissett was saying they look scary. It was hard to disagree with him, especially when we're going to consider the league results that they went on to to achieve a couple of nights ago. But sticking with the semi-finals just for the minute, Chelsea beat Crystal Palace 2-0 on Sunday. Loftus-Cheek with an absolute screamer in the 65th, and Mason Mount with a deft touch and nice finish 11 minutes later to put that one to bed. And it's going to be a Chelsea-Liverpool final. You know, the kind of teams you'd expect to find in the end of that competition for the last few years.
Who you got winning it?
Oh, you got to go with Liverpool, man. They look like they're really hitting their stride. Like, really hitting their stride, man. Man down under style. They're in the league, they've made it 4 wins out of 5. On Tuesday, they beat Man U 4-0. They absolutely battered them. Luis Diaz and Sadio Mane, they scored either side of Mo Salah's brace. Now, remember, Liverpool beat United at Old Trafford 5-0 earlier this season. And Salah was like the first player ever to score in the Premier League 3 goals against them at Old Trafford. So the balance of power in that rivalry shifted a while ago. But I think the evidence has been more emphatic this year than any other time. Like, you wouldn't bet a penny on United to beat Liverpool. And Ronaldo was notably absent due to the tragic death of his infant son. And they held a round of applause in the 7th minute of the game as a sign of respect. That was like horrible news, man. Proper horrible.
Awful, yeah.
So, yeah, it was glad to see that pretty much everyone at Anfield was like clapping away, and there was no derision, no, like, you know, horrible behaviour sometimes that you see, especially at the football. I think, you know, the lads been on the session all day, and the rivalry between two teams is quite hot, but it's nice to see everyone abiding by that sign of respect. And this result had ramifications for the top four. The night after United got absolutely rinsed, Arsenal unexpectedly won away at Stamford Bridge for the second season in a row. It was probably the worst defensive display from Chelsea that I've seen in a long time. They were defending like Arsenal 2011 style, absolutely clueless. Like, you could blow on the ball and it would find its way into the net. Eddie Nketiah opening the scoring. Emil Smith Rowe with the second. Both of these were cancelled out by a heavily deflected Timo Werner goal and a very tidy finish from defender and captain Azpilicueta. Nketiah grabbed his second early in the second half, and Bukayo Saka sealed the win in the second minute of added time from the penalty spot. And after 3 straight defeats, Arsenal have pulled themselves somehow back into 5th position with a game in hand over United, and they're only behind Tottenham on goal difference. It's unreal. Like, the race for top four is ridiculous. Now, we were saying same old Arsenal, and I'd be the first one to cuss them. They've just pissed me off so many times. But, and again, I'm not trying to stick the boot into United fans, but I am a little bit. They're so bad at the minute. I feel like I can count on them to be worse than Arsenal. You know what I mean? Now, the only other team to worry about then is Tottenham, because they've been absolutely smashing it in the previous week. So we'll see how that goes. But
how buzzing are you to see Arsenal smashing it again?
It's, you know, do you remember that scene from The Matrix where Neo's in the subway station and he looks at the stairs?
At the end.
Yeah. And he's like looking at the stairs and Trinity's going, run, Neo, run. And he turns back to fight the agents. And she's like, yeah, what is he doing? And Morpheus says, he's beginning to believe. And that's me. That is me right now, man. So I don't want to throw out a glitch in the Matrix, but I've got my fingers crossed. Let's put it that way. There's like 6 games to go. A lot can happen. But the more important result from last night for probably 80% of fans out there was Man City's 3-0 win over Brighton. Mahrez, Foden and Silva breaking down the walls of Jericho in the second half. That meant that they reclaimed the top spot from Liverpool, who had went to the top of the table with that win over United. Liverpool, in the last 5 games, they've won 4, drew 1. And Man City, a bit of a checkerboard there. They've won 3 and drawn 2. So, and they're both on 32 games. Man City are on 77 points. Liverpool sitting on 76. And they're 14 points ahead of Chelsea in third. So it is a 2-horse race at this point.
All right, looks like they got Watford next, then Leeds, then Newcastle.
Is that Liverpool or Man City?
Man City.
Watford, Leeds, Newcastle. That's quite nice, man.
That's not bad, is it?
What about Liverpool?
Everton, Newcastle, Tottenham. Newcastle are fucked, man.
Nah, you know, I know they're going to be getting absolutely spit roasted by both the top tier teams, man. Unreal. But you know, Newcastle are doing all right. You know, I was looking at the relegation battle. And they're all the way up in 11th. Like, they're sitting pretty. They're going nowhere near relegation. They've been smashing it, man. They've just been picking up points. They've won their last 3 after losing 2. I think they drew the other day. Your man, like, what's his name? That French lad whose name escapes me, scored an absolute banger into the top left corner. They're safe, man. They're going forward. Money in their pockets, man. Absolutely unreal. Mbappe, Neymar, Haaland, they're all going there, man. That's what I heard.
I called this episodes ago, weeks ago. I said they ain't getting relegated, and they're going. They're winning Premier League next year, man.
Yeah, didn't you say that to Bissett in private, and then he presented it as his own opinion on the podcast? I think that's what.
Oh
happened.
Yeah.
Oh no, he's always doing that, isn't he, man? Absolutely slack. But we'll move on to the other end of the table, to the relegation battle. Norwich, Watford, Burnley and Everton can all still get relegated. Villa are teetering just above, but fair play to Stevie G and the lads. They're safe now. Even if it's only about a point or two, like, they're going nowhere. I wonder what will happen with their superstar lineup next season. I don't know if Coutinho is going to stay, etc. But yeah, interesting. And it's as far as maiden seasons go in the Premier League, Stevie G's done all right, man. They've had a few top quality wins along the way. Maybe a little bit inconsistent, but, you know, it's a competitive league and they are, in terms of resources, they're not near the top, you know, so it's good going, really.
It's great. He joined, what, like halfway through? He's done a great job.
So they're not involved directly for themselves in the relegation battle, but Burnley, they're in 18th with 25 points and play Southampton tonight. That is a very, very important game for them, especially after losing Sean Dyche, their 10-year manager. That's one that's been, I've still been thinking about that. Like, he's kept Burnley in the Premier League against all odds for a long time. I don't know what's been going on. It must be some behind-the-scenes politics-type bullshit, because it can't be based on his record. I just can't see that, to be honest. And Norwich are bottom. They're dead bottom. And I was looking at some odds earlier, and they're saying, like, 98% likely that Norwich are going down. They've got 21 points, and they were just beaten 3-2 by United last weekend. A Ronaldo old school hat trick sealing that result for them. Everton just scraped a point with a 1-1 draw against Leicester. They've made scoring late a bit of a habit recently. It's been a bleak few months at Goodison Park, and it looks like they're still scrapping to stay up, man. I mean, how many episodes have we talked about their demise and Lampard's approach, etc.? But they're showing they're willing, even if everything's not clicking on a tactical level on the pitch. And Watford, they're 19th with 22 points. They were beaten by Brentford 2-1 on Saturday. And a fair play to Brentford, because They beat Arsenal on the opening day and kept themselves in the league after promotion last season. Those lads stepped up their game big time, so maximum respect there. And I'm going to pass over to Flynn for the five things that you might have missed if you were pissed. Go on, Flynn.
If you were pissed, which we often are. So first up on the five things, Wimbledon 2022, Russian and Belarusian players have been banned from the tournament. The All England Lawn Tennis Club, get this, said it had the responsibility to limit Russia's global influence through the strongest means possible. Is that really their job, the All England Lawn Tennis Club?
If anyone's got the means to do that, it is the All England Lawn Tennis Club. I would say it's perfectly within their remit. I think sometimes we get a little bit scared of the power that the All England Lawn Tennis Club actually holds. You know, I think Putin and the boys should be very wary, very wary indeed. It's the same thing though, and it's like, it's just slack. It's just slack on like Russian, Belarus, anyone who's politically tied to the other side, for them to be punished by it. Like, we've spoke about it loads of times. I do think it's pretty harsh, but you know, with great power comes great responsibility, and they're wielding theirs as well as this.
Look, if you look into it online on some of them dodgy websites, there are documents, and they say that that's what this is all about. Putin was scared of the reach of the All England Lawn Tennis Club. They were getting a bit too close to his borders. There were talk of Finland joining the All England Lawn Tennis Club. There was talk of Turkey joining. Oh, mate, look into it. Right, on to number two, five things you might have missed. Hall of Fame tennis player Pam Shriver says that she was in an inappropriate, damaging relationship with her coach when she was 17. The coach, a classic pedo name, Don Candy, he met her at 15 years old, but they started a relationship at 17 and it didn't get sexual until she turned 20. She says that he never abused her sexually. She says that like she was in love with him and all that, but he was married. But she did say that there was emotional abuse. But this is just like classic case of grooming. And she says this is rampant between coaches and young female athletes. What do you make of this one?
You know me, Flynn. I'm not one for paedophilic conspiracies. But of course, that's what if you were that way inclined, that would be the first thing you'd look to do. Oh, how do I just get close to kids and then be in a position of trust? I'll just be a sports coach. Sweet. It happens so often. Obviously, like, this doesn't surprise me at all. It's so depressing that it's not surprising to me. Do you know what I mean? I think I seen something the other day in a BBC article. The cyclist Bradley Wiggins, he said his coach was grooming him. Do you know what I mean?
Yeah.
And then, like, other people, like Sugar Ray Leonard, one of the best fighters of all time, one of his coaches sexually assaulted him when he was a kid. It's just all over the place, man. It's absolutely horrible.
See, that's the one sport where I wouldn't become a coach if I wanted to groom the young athletes, is like ones where they know how to fight.
Yeah, probably not the best. So what we're learning about you, Flynn, is that you would be a particularly thoughtful Peter.
Just one who's concerned about self-preservation.
I mean, aren't they all? I mean, very strategic Peter game there. So well done to you. But yeah, obviously, all joking aside, that is absolutely... I mean, again, like... That's that version of events, to get it right, if their relationship started when she was 17, obviously he's old, but it's unseemly. But in the UK, it's not even illegal, you know? It's not even... So, like, that's where it gets even more weird. Like, obviously, it's gross, but it's not illegal here. It's like that Prince Andrew thing. But obviously, that's probably a bigger topic for another day. Probably a different podcast, I'd imagine.
So we've pivoted again. No longer about Hulk Hogan. Welcome to the Bull Chat Pedo Podcast, where we discuss the ethics and morals of paedophilia. Is it wrong? Is it all that bad?
Yeah. We're all human beings at the end of the day, and we're accepting of whoever you are. You know. Oh my god. Yeah. This is
degenerated.
This is forever. But Onto a more serious topic, a more traditional topic for the Ball Chat Sports Podcast. Go on, Flynn, take it away. Number three.
Bodybuilding star Cedric McMillan, winner of the 2017 Arnold Classic, has sadly died at the age of 44 years old. hugely influential bodybuilder, as I'm sure you agree, Jim. He also had wins at the 2011 Orlando Show of Champions and the New York Pro in 2012. Also finished in the top 10 of Mr. Olympia multiple times. Never got that coveted number one spot, but a real legend has departed the scene. And reports say that he went out as he lived, heart attack whilst on the treadmill. Swole is the goal.
Swole is the goal, and RIP to Cedric McMillan. I mean, you know, we can all drool over the legends of the sport. Arnold, you know. We're talking Ronnie Coleman, Jay Cutler. I can read them off. Frank Zane.
Four-time Mr. Olympia, Jay Cutler.
Yeah, we're talking maybe 8-time champion Lee Haney. Is that what we're talking about? We are...
I heard he dated Victoria Silverstead, Playmate of the Year.
And the rest of them, mate. The whole Playboy Mansion, that's what I was. But yeah, we can all drool over the megastars, but the whole sport is comprised of men like Cedric McMillan. You know, fourth place here, fifth place there. Oh, maybe a podium here. Probably pushing himself to like dangerous levels of low body fat just to squeeze into those tiny little Y fronts. And to get your vascularity down to 2% body fat, ooze. Do you know what I mean? So it's I think it's the sport of kings. That's what I've heard it described. We've lost a member of the royal family. That's how I would honestly look at it.
The world has lost a great man. We're having a bit of fun today. We're taking the piss because Bissett isn't here. We all know he doesn't like bodybuilding, he doesn't like WWE. So let's get back. He doesn't like the pedo top. So we're going to just get back on track and start talking about things that Bissett would approve of. So let's just crack on with number four. Ex-WWE star Bubba Ray Dudley appeared on Stone Cold Steve Austin's Broken Schools podcast this week. Fantastic interview. He gave great insight into the now legendary TLC match at WrestleMania 17. And what was quite interesting, he talked about how they decided some of the bumps that went down. And funnily enough, it turns out that he... Edge and Matt Hardy were like the brains of the operation. It was super interesting. And he said that they had fierce debates. There's two. So that match is, as of course you're aware, Jim, is famous for two bumps. One, when I think it's Bubba Ray for sure. And I think it's him and Matt Hardy on top of a ladder, really tall ladder. The ladder gets pushed over. They fall like 20 foot through four tables. That's bump one. The other famous bump is Jeff Hardy's hanging. It's because it's a TLC match. The whole point of the match is you've got to grab the belt that's hanging suspended above the ring. Jeff Hardy's hanging off the belt. Edge climbs a ladder at the other side of the ring, jumps off it and spears him. It's like a legendary moment of the sport. Bubba Ray Dudley believed that the spear should go next because he said, look, that's a once in a lifetime sort of bump. But he lost out to Edge, who was actually wanting the Bubba Ray falling off the ladder bump to be the final bump. But yeah, super, super interesting interview. I'd recommend anyone out there have a little listen to it. Any thoughts on that there, Jim?
Around this time was when I really started getting into wrestling and like understanding it past that level of, this is like a weird kind of fighting theatrical kind of thing, like starting to understand what's going on. And, I love this shit, man. I watched this match loads of times, you know, loads of times. The ladder matches in the 90s were just a regular household set of ladders, like still high enough, but that initial step was nothing compared to the size of these industrial ladders that they brought out in the early 2000s and like falling high off there, man. Like that spear that you were talking about, that is a ruthless thing to do. Like basically they are like stuntmen, aren't they? Like Hollywood stuntmen in what they do. But they're doing it real time in front of like probably 70,000 people. It's close to that at the Houston Astrodome 2001. I even remember the setting, mate. Don't watch me. I think I've read Edge's autobiography. I think I've read Mick Foley's one like countless times. Beyond the Mat, one of my favorite documentaries ever. But yeah, proper geek and wrestling in the early 2000s and even later on. I'm definitely going to give that a listen. And it makes me kind of sad that I don't watch wrestling anymore, but every time I tune into wrestling, I just think, oh, this wasn't like, it's not as good as it used to be. Obviously, I'm older, but I think I could get into it if it was still Attitude Era. You know what I mean? If you smell what The Rock is cooking, those type vibes.
I agree with you. I don't know if it's just that we're older, but it's the Attitude Era was incredible. The superstars, Stone Cold, The Rock, The Dudley Boys, The Hardy Boys, Undertaker, Kane, Jericho, Kurt Angle, Olympic wrestling champion, Kurt Angle. Incredible. And then they say that the death knell of that that era was the Invasion era, which I think it gets a little bit of hate these days, but I think the Invasion era was fucking cool, man. You know, when Vince bought WCW and ECW and then they attacked the WWE show and beat the shit out of all their boys. It was amazing.
That was the, I did allude to it briefly in the preamble, but yeah, like they absorbed all the best talent from WCW and basically shit on every single one of them. I think Booker T was the only one to come through. Like, even notable faces from WCW that were out of contract or the purchase of WCW didn't encompass their contracts. Like Scott Steiner, he made his debut the next year. You know, he was like a massive face of WCW. He'd been in WWE in the early 90s, him and his brother Rick. And it's like, aside from those handful of guys, they were just getting squashed left, right and center. The only time it was competitive was when they did, I think it was it Unforgiven, where they had the inaugural brawl. It was like a five-man tag team match.
Amazing. I think they called it Invasion, didn't they, that pay-per-view?
Maybe, yeah. I think they did, yeah, to be fair.
I think it was supposed to be Unforgiven or No Way Out or something. They renamed it Invasion, the five versus five match. And Stone Cold, Judas, WWE.
Oh, mate. You didn't even need to know why it happened. It just happened. You were like, what the fuck is going on, man? The Texas Rattlesnake, mate. It's as WWE as it gets. Come on, man. What's going on?
Oh, that was brutal. Because whenever the brawls were going down, leading up to that pay-per-view, the WCW boys will be beating on the WWE boys. Stone Cold would always come out and just save the day and get the huge pop from the audience. It was amazing. And then he Judas'd his own boys. It was incredible.
Yeah, they used to let Undertaker do that one as well. I think he was still in the American Badass stage at that point, you know, coming out to Limp Bizkit on his fucking Harley Davidson and that. And then he'd come out. He had like a proper sick entrance tune. Kurt Angle had a sick banging entrance tune. It was just like trumpets or whatever. But every time you heard it, everyone would just be like, whoa, sick. So nuts, man. And for Bizkit is going to be punching his fucking dashboard right now.
Oh, I saw a great video of Kurt Angle the other day. He just made like a surprise appearance at like a really small UK wrestling promotion. And you see the phone footage from the crowd. You hear his theme tune start and the whole crowd are just like, nah. And Kurt Angle for real just comes out that the crowd goes nuts. Really worth checking out.
I'd be geeking out hard on that, man. But I can't believe the wrestling talk is deep, so deeper than I thought it was going to be. I thought we were just going to touch on it, like, but we're actually going down memory lane. Like, remember SmackDown 5 levels, mate? Absolutely sick.
Elimination chamber. Look, when are we going to get this chance again?
Never.
The 100th episode. Like,
oh, he's never going to let it happen. He's probably going to sack us both, man, next week. Go on, last one, then we'll last one for the top things, and then we'll get onto the fight.
So, number five, football players' salaries have been revealed by LaMarca. And it looks like Gareth Bale has snuck onto the podium. But we'll come back to that. We've got in League 1, Neymar gets 30 million euros after tax. He gets paid like 46 or something, but then after tax, he gets about 30 million. La Liga, Gareth Bale's the highest paid player in La Liga. 34 million euros before tax, though. And Spain, they're a bit strict on the taxes. It looks like he could lose about 45% of that just to taxes. But did you ever see him being the highest paid player in Spain?
It's easy to overlook now on the back of so much inactivity from Gareth Bale in a Real Madrid shirt, just how electric he was back in the day. He was setting shit on fire when he was in his prime. He was in the conversation for top 2-3 players in the world. There's no doubt about it. When he left Tottenham Hotspur, when he went to Real Madrid, he was one alongside Ronaldo, ironically, in the same team, and probably Messi and one or two others. He was up there. So because he was going at the age he was going at, because he was such a flair player, because he could do spectacular things, he was like a thoroughbred Galactico. He was meant to go to Real Madrid. But with that kind of signing, you have to make a lot of commercial noise, you know. And that deal was worth a lot of money to Tottenham Hotspur, a lot of money to Gareth Bale. And because of that aspect of getting him in his prime, getting him striking while the iron's hot, I think his premium went way up. And obviously, if you've got an agent in your corner who knows he's got one of the hottest properties in world football, he's just going to drive everything he can up because that's just going to increase his cut in it. So I do remember when he went to Real Madrid, and it wasn't a surprise that they made this kind of deal. I think Ronaldo, I might be speaking out of turn here in terms of their base salaries, but I think Ronaldo might have had a touch more while he was there. And I think, you know, because Messi's left as well, that might have just bumped him up a little bit in terms of his Spanish earnings. But doesn't surprise me that Neymar is getting that much money either for similar reasons. Flair player, he'll be on like the cover of FIFA. He's the player that kids want their name on the back of the shirt. Do you know what I mean? He's one of those, very profitable. And Ronaldo, what can you say? I'm surprised he doesn't earn double that. He's just a ridiculous commercial property. He'll continue to be. He'll be like Beckham. You know, after like Beckham hasn't played in years and he's just there, just about, just earning tens of millions off like aftershave and that. So these guys are very, very valuable. So it doesn't surprise me. No.
Speaking of Ronaldo, he is the top earner in the Premier League. 31.5 million euros before tax. And I couldn't find how much he's going to get taxed, but I'm sure it'll be a lot lower than Spain. So he's still earning heaps. But it surprised me as well, of the top 10 highest paid athletes in the Premier League, five of them were from Man U. That team's spending an awful lot, but it's not really paying off. And the other five, I think, were Man City. I didn't really see a Liverpool or anything in there.
Yeah, Bissett has spoken a lot about Liverpool and Jurgen Klopp and their whole backroom team, their eye for a bargain. They get world-class players for fuck all. Like, they don't often break that 50, 60, 70 million mark. Like, Arsenal have done it several times to no great effect over the past few years. I mean, Man United, I think that's a large part of the reason why their fans are so frustrated, because it's not as if they haven't got the resources. You know, it's clearly a footballing issue and a club issue. Like, if they didn't have money to spend, that would be like a viable thing to point out and say, yeah, well, if we had the same amount of money to spend as Man City, we'd be doing that. Well, they do, and they haven't been doing that. So this is why there's so much excitement about Ten Hag coming in. I've said before, I think there's a bit of a curse on that club for like the next few years. I hope I'm wrong, because, you know, the more good teams playing good football, the better for me as a mostly neutral spectator. But yeah, they've been absolutely flopping it, man. Absolutely.
Quiz for you. Out of the, let's see how many of the top five highest paid players in the Premier League are. So we know Ronaldo's number one. Who are the other four, do you think?
Mo Salah?
Nah, he's not even in the top 10.
That's mad. That is mental, you know, that he's not in the top 10 earners. All right, so you gave me a little clue earlier, didn't you?
So, no Liverpool players.
No Liverpool players, okay. Mm-mm. So, Kevin De Bruyne?
Yeah, number two.
Okay, nice. Harry Maguire?
Not in the top 10.
Oh, wait. Pogba. Is Pogba up there?
He's 10th.
Oh, he's 10th. Snuck in there. The sneaky beast.
Snuck in there, sneaky boy.
Sneaky little boy.
So the next three, four and five are all Man U players.
Go on, put me out my misery.
De Gea, Sancho and Varane.
De Gea is one of the top earners.
The third.
That's mental. I mean, I think he just surpassed Roy Keane's appearance record for United. Or he passed some kind of milestone that's going to have Roy Keane absolutely spitting feathers because he hates all young players. Like, but that is quite surprising because he's a keeper as well. You know what I mean? His agent must be absolutely sick, man.
Yeah, really surprising top 10 there. It was only Man U with, like, let me just double check. There was 5 players from Man U, 1, 2, 3 from Man City, and 2 from Chelsea. Really surprising list there.
Who are the 2 from Chelsea? Lukaku.
Lukaku at number 6 and Kante at 9th.
Kante, oh, come on. Doesn't get his respect. Sixth highest earner in the Premier League and everyone loves him. Absolutely sick. But thank you for putting together that top 5 things you might have missed, because I was planning to get on it after work today and I came on the script and find all this lovely green writing, which indicates that Flynn's been hard at work. So we are going to move on to the featured fights for this week. Errol Spence stopped Jorgensen Ugas in the 10th round last weekend in Arlington, Texas, collecting his third welterweight title and bringing us, hopefully, one step closer to what is becoming one of the most sought-after fights in world boxing, and that's Spence versus Terence Crawford. And just a little recap of the fight. After two close rounds to start the fight, Spence just started pouring it on him. Now, his work wasn't as clean as I've seen it in past fights, especially against Lamont Peterson and Danny Garcia. But I think he made the right decision in avoiding a boxing match with a Cuban stylist and sacrificing some accuracy for activity. And Ugas, he had his best moments in the sixth round. He knocked Spence's mouthpiece out. And in a brief moment of confusion, he followed up with a right hand that knocked Spence into the ropes. You don't often see that with lads fighting Errol Spence. Usually he's pretty immovable. And because the ropes kept him up, that should have been called a knockdown, but it wasn't. It was one of those weird little lapses of concentration from both Errol Spence and the referee. However, Spence quickly recovered and picked up where he left off. Now, ultimately, he smashed Ugas's orbital bone around his right eye, which led to the stoppage. That's pretty much, it can be a career ender. Like, it happened to Kell Brook against Gennady Golovkin. It happened to Antonio Margarito against Manny Pacquiao. Once that area of your face is compromised to that extent, it's very difficult to come back from. And you have to give credit to Spence because he put on such an impressive display after a year and a half out with his own injury. He had a retinal tear that he had to get surgically repaired. And again, we were talking about Sugar Ray Leonard earlier. This is an injury that he suffered in his career, and he had to take 3 years out of the ring, nearly 5 years, actually. It can be a severe, it can severely hamper your just your vision, and not just in your career, but for the rest of your life. So he did well to bounce back from that. And after the fight, he called out Crawford. So hopefully this is going to bring us one step closer. The political situation has kind of cleared itself up. So I'm really hoping before the end of the year that they can get that fight on before something else happens, or someone has a car crash, or someone gets shot, or someone gets a bit too old, or, you know, just let the planets align for this one. But earlier that same evening in Manchester, Conor Benn, son of the great destroyer, Nigel Benn, he extended his unbeaten streak to 21-0, scoring his 14th KO against Chris Van Heerden in the second round. Van Heerden looked tidy in the first, but was hurt by Ben's first real charge. And this was basically a repeat of the Chris Algieri fight from a few months ago. A lot of people, including the fluoride-free Carl Froch, want Ben to face the European champion, David Avanesian, next. I would love to see that fight, but I can't see Fast Car Ready putting one of his last crown jewels in with a serious, dangerous fighter. So I think we're going to see a couple more outings of him knocking over fighters that are fairly far over the hill. And in Coventry, the show that we talked about last week briefly, Jimmy Hutton and Young Jalen, they had a great time. They saw Dylan Chima beating Brian Charlton in the final of the Boxer Lightweight tournament there. That was a decent scrap. I think there was a few good contests on that card, and I'm glad they had a decent night. I've since went back and watched a few of the fights, and because it's not the highest level, you're not talking British, world, European level or anything like that, but because they're evenly matched, it's just competitive. You don't really want to see squash matches all the time, do you? That's one of the things you could criticize boxing for, is one too many squash matches, really. And over to MMA, and your boy, Bilal Muhammad, beat Vicente Luque by unanimous decision in their rematch on Sunday night. Flynn, you watched the entire fight card. I've only caught bits and bobs and highlights. I know you've had an issue with a few of the stoppages. I want you to give us your thoughts on the main event, where you think Bilal Muhammad can go from here, and what was wrong with those stoppages in particular.
Yeah, so the main event, look, overall the card was like pretty enjoyable. It was at the Apex in Nevada, so it's only the crowd's small. I don't know if it was just a few hundred people there, 1,000 at the most. So the excitement wasn't there from the crowd. And there was just, it was a weird night with weird decisions. And so, yeah, we'll start with the main event. Vicente Luque, Bilal Muhammad. Bilal wins unanimous decision. Fair enough. He clearly dominated that fight. but it's a he was such a boring fighter. This is the first fight of his I've seen, by the way. And from what I gather, he's a serial offender of this sort of thing. He gets you down on the ground. He gets you down on the ground, and he causes no damage. He's dominant. He's strong enough to keep people on the ground, but he doesn't do anything with it. There's no threat of submission. His striking is decent enough, but there just wasn't much of it. And every single round, his takedowns were class. They were beautiful, the takedowns. Every single one was really good, and they looked quite vicious, like he'd slammed Luque down a few times. But once he had him on the floor, that was it. He just held him there. No submissions, no damage from any of these takedowns. And by the end of it, fair enough, he completely deserved the win, but he called out Hamza after he won, I think. He called Colby out. But then since then, on Twitter, he's called out Hamza and Colby, and I think Usman, and he does not deserve that. That's not the fight we deserve, man. Like, fair enough, he's good enough to go against these elite guys, but that's not why I watch this sport, and I don't think it's why anyone else watches this sport. We like seeing people win technically, but we don't like watching really boring fighters. So sack him, Dana.
Yeah, it's like you say, there were aspects of his striking game where I noticed, again, I just watched the highlights, but his left kick to the body looked sweet as anything. Very crisp, very clean. I noticed that he would land his jab and he would continually miss with his right hand. His right hand was always going off center, like over Vicente Luque's left shoulder. There's an issue there in terms of coordination. Maybe it's the way Luque was moving. In the exchanges, the striking exchanges, you could see that if they stayed there, Luque had the advantage. And I said to you before, like, this is a guy who's already, this was a rematch, wasn't it? So he's already knocked him out. Luque already knocked him out cold. So in terms of being cautious, I can understand his game plan. You know, in fact, I would say, like, that is the perfect way to go. You know, you don't want to get ego involved and you don't want to start trading up punches with someone who's got the striking advantage. You would need to play to your strengths, and Bilal did that. But it's like you say, there's something very ungraceful about the way he moves around the ring. It's almost, for me, it's almost an aesthetic issue as much as an excitement issue. Like, I don't like the way he scuttles around the cage from side to side and kind of throw in weird little backhand slap punches that remind me of Ben Askren. And I certainly don't like his refusal to advance his position on the ground. He's completely content to just exist in that position. Like I said to you before, like, he threatened a choke just so the referee wouldn't say stand up. And then he pulled his arm out and he would tap him again and kind of maul him a little bit. And it's like, what are you trying to do? Are you trying to make this last longer than it has to? Because it looks like he's got a submission game. Obviously, he's got a wrestling strength. I don't know where his head's at. And I'm similar to you. I'm new to Bilal Muhammad. The first time I seen him was against Leon Edwards. And an eye poke ended that fight. And I thought, that must be so scary, like thinking you're going to go blind or whatever. And he was like crying almost in the octagon because he was so scared. And I had a lot of sympathy for him. But since then, like, this big talk, man. I was like thinking you didn't have that big talk when you were crying in the octagon, man. Daniel Cormier, after he fought Stipe Miocic for the third time, his eye was literally inside out. And he's like, I can't see out my left eye. Like, next question, basically. But I didn't catch any of the co-main event. Is it, how do you say that? Chao Braulio versus Gadji Omargadziev.
Yeah, so I think it's Caio Baraglio and Gadji Omargadziev, I'm going to guess, or Gadziev. But I was super hyped for this because we had a Brazilian BJJ expert going up against a Dagestani wrestler. Dream, absolute dream matchup. And it was decent. It was a decent matchup, man. It was a strange ending, though. Decent matchup. So it was a technical decision, the second one of the night. What happened? It looked like it got to the third round. Baraglio was dominating a lot of the time, but it was quite exciting. There's a lot of ground game, obviously. But during the third round, Baraglio threw a knee whilst his opponent's hand was still on the canvas, and it was ruled unintentional. But so the match gets stopped. You know, you get the old 5 minutes to see if you're okay. But the doctor came up. Doctor stepped into the ring. He sat down with the Dagestani dude, Omar Gadziev. The doctor ruled that he was okay to continue, but Omar Gadziev didn't want to continue. And so it went to the judges' scorecards. Instead of it being ruled a disqualification or a no contest, and the second time this happened tonight, we'll talk about the first in a minute, and the ref decided this one should go to the scorecards. And of course, Baraglio had won like the first two rounds, and he'd had a point deducted because of that shot in a third, but it didn't matter. He went to the scorecards. And I just think this sets up a bit of a dangerous precedent. It's happened in an earlier fight with Chris Barnett and Martin Bude. Chris Barnett, you see him on all the highlight reels. He's that real chunky dude, the heavyweight who dropped someone with that spinning back kick and then did a front flip while he celebrated. Amazing.
I remember him doing a front flip and landing on his ass, and I just felt a twinge in my lower back.
Yeah, he was amazing in his last fight. And he tried to pull out some of that stuff. He was on the prelim. He tried to pull out some of that stuff last weekend, but Bude was a bit too wise to it. I think he was expecting something like that, and he held him against the cage for like three rounds, basically. It was a bit of a boring matchup, except in the third round, he went for an illegal elbow to the back of Barnett's neck. Or probably, I think it's more to the back of his head. Again, he went down, and to me, it looked like he was milking it a little bit. It looked like he was hoping for a win by disqualification here. The doctor comes in to examine him and rules that he can't continue to fight. So it looks like, is this going to be another disqualification like Jan and Sterling? But then the ref says this goes to the scorecards. And as soon as he said that, Barnett, who'd been on the floor like squirming, suddenly kind of sits up and is like, what? Like, he's suddenly all right. I'm sure he was hoping for that win by disqualification. But see, it happened two times in the night. It was pretty awkward both times. Like, it looked unprofessional. It didn't look like a UFC event when they were all sitting around debating what to do about this situation. Like, you know, they should have had something better in place. But to me, imagine if you think you've won round one and two, you get into the final round, you gassed, maybe you've took a few bad shots, you've eaten a few bad shots. I don't know, you're worried you might get knocked out or something, or you're getting taken down for submission. You could now go for an illegal shot and get that match ended. And then you could win based on what you did in round one and two. And I think that system, that precedent they've set up on last weekend, and I know it already existed, but I think that precedent can be abused, and I think it might be.
That is a dangerous precedent, and I think it might be, at least in part, in reaction to what we saw between Aljamain Sterling and Petr Yan last year, whereby you saw an illegal knee go in, and both the referee and the cage side doctor were asking Aljamain Sterling if he was okay, and putting him in that position, you know, to make the decision for himself when it shouldn't have really been like that. So I do understand what you're saying. And I think there is, listen, any advantage you can get, you're going to get. Any tactical ploy you can execute, you're going to do it. It's about winning at the end of the day. The morals or the ethics of it are really, it's very individual. I'm not making any judgments on that level, but I completely agree with you that fighters will use this to their advantage if this is the new precedent. I'm not sure if there's been an official rule change that would necessitate this, but I do think the Aljamain Sterling and Petr Yan first fight, what happened there really plays into it. There are other examples like Diego Sanchez versus Michel Pereira, an illegal blow. Diego Sanchez says, no, I'm not all right to continue. They disqualify Pereira. On the flip side, John Jones versus Anthony Smith. John Jones kneed him when he was down, similar position. Anthony Smith says, nah, fuck that. Like, I'm carrying on. Lost the fight. He could have been the light heavyweight champion of the world. On that, he valued what he saw as his pride above a cheap victory. There are a lot of factors into these kind of things. But if you think you can see a bit of play acting and you think you can see a little bit of gamesmanship in there, then listen, it's going to happen, isn't it? It's going to happen. At least it will provide us with some funny moments, man. One way or the other, it's hard to judge.
I would do it for sure. Any chance I get.
In pro wrestling, they call that selling. If you sell the big move. Just
yeah. So that's just what makes it a real sport.
Yeah, that's just, yeah, no, I just want to legitimize MMA and UFC in general. But over to UFC's competitors, Bellator. They had some big news last Friday with Patricio Pitbull becoming a three-time featherweight champion with his unanimous decision win over AJ McKee. This one was closely contested on the feet despite the size disparity between them. AJ McKee is long, lanky. They don't look like they're in the same division to me. But Patricio stuck in there. A lot of experience this guy's got. He also came very close to a third round finish with a guillotine against the fence. The judges had him doing enough over the distance, although McKee was clearly shocked and, you know, he just lost his title. Maybe a lot of emotions there. Looked like a fair result to me. All round off the retrospective with former UFC featherweight and Conor McGregor press conference victim Jeremy Stephens. He headlined a PFL card against Clay Collard last night. Unfortunately, he lost a three-round unanimous decision to continue his late career slide. Now, just to put that in perspective, he's nearly breaking even after 49 pro fights. He's 35 years old. Maybe it's time to slide over to the coaching side of the sport, man, because it's a tough game to be being the punch bagging. Now, what I meant by Conor McGregor press conference victim is Jeremy Stephens was the guy who piped up whilst Conor McGregor was on the mic, and McGregor turned around and goes, "Who the fuck is that guy?" So yeah, immortal. Absolutely slaying. Everyone laughs.
Legendary moment. That was amazing.
Yeah. It was that. And what was the other one? It was Red Panty Night, wasn't it? For Donald Cerrone. He's like,
Red Panty Night. Yeah, bust out the red panties.
Conor's made us rich. Break out the red panties. We've got the McGregor fight. That was when McGregor was good and wholesome and, you know, everything was right in the world. But we'll move on and we'll look ahead. We want to give credit to one fight in particular, but we'll start with the accompaniments for the evening. So in an effort to keep up to date with ONE FC's schedule, notwithstanding my glaring omission of the ONE X retrospective, I have given Urksil versus Sadikovic for their lightweight kickboxing title more of a run-in than probably any other fight in the pod's history. That's tomorrow night, and I bet you I forget to cover it next week with all the excitement of Tyson Fury, so put a pin in that one. And Bellator are running their 278 and 279 events back-to-back in Hawaii over Thursday and Friday with all female fights topping the cards. You've got Juliana Velasquez versus Liz Carmouche for the flyweight title on Thursday. Then on Friday, Chris Cyborg defends her featherweight belt against Arlene Blanco. Juan Archuleta defends his bantamweight title in chief support there against Rofian Stutz. Also on Friday, over to the boxing now, you've got John Riel Casimiro defending his WBO bantamweight title against Paul Butler at the Echo Arena in Liverpool. Now, former super flyweight champion Butler has only lost twice and at the highest level. However, Casimiro holds wins over Charlie Edwards, Zelani Tete, who knocked out Butler in 2015, and Guillermo Rigondeaux. That last victory, I rate very highly because, for me, Guillermo Rigondeaux is like an all-time great. I think on his day, he'd give anyone trouble. So I don't care if he was 39 and running away all night, he'd still beat him. So Casimiro, he's a seriously vicious fighter. He's a bit of an animal, to be honest with you. You can maybe catch him off guard. I think he lost a decision in the Philippines like four fights ago against no one you've ever heard of. But in the big fights, he turns up. And I do hope Butler can pull it off, but I really don't fancy his chances. Which brings us to Sunday night. The UFC are back. And OnlyFans veteran Jessica Andrade is back to the UFC main event against Amanda Lemos. And overall, Bellator and UFC included, sisters are doing it for themselves, man. In the MMA world, absolutely love it. MMA is the sport that has coaxed me into watching more women's sport in general.
100%. Often one of the most brutal fights on the card is the women's fight in the UFC. It's brilliant. WWE as well, the women's fights have suddenly got really good in the last few years.
Well, I think they've been good a while before that. Do you remember Trish Stratus versus Lita? The women's championship in 2002. Just so happened that they were the two most attractive females in the company, but that's got nothing to do with it.
Here's the thing. Glory days of men's WWE was the Attitude Era and the early invasion days for sure. But the women's fights, come on, like what was it? The they had like what stripping matches and like real gimmicky stuff like this. But these days, the women's fights in the WWE are awesome. With a is it Ric Flair's daughter?
You know what? I'm not upset. The only one I still recognize is Stephanie McMahon. That's the only one I still know.
She's still there. Now, Ric Flair's daughter, Charlotte Flair, I think she's cool. She's awesome. Multiple-time world champion. She's really good. There's a lot of good female talent in WWE and UFC, of course, and which we didn't touch on, actually, the other night as a women's fight. One of the better fights of the whole night, actually. Absolute war.
I mean, who can forget Zhang Weili versus Joanna Jędrzejczyk? They beat the living shit out of each other, man. Like, actually difficult to watch, you know? With thoughts of, like, you don't look at them like, oh, these are two women fighting, because their technique is so clean. Yeah, as I say, man, it's got me into women's sports a lot more in general. But as I've alluded to, these are mere accompaniments to the main event of the weekend. These are a crusty red sauce battle by a sizzling steak, because we're about to cover the highest attended fight in recent memory with perhaps the worst undercard of all time. It is, of course, Tyson Fury versus Dillian White for the WBC and Ring Heavyweight Championships of the World. It feels for me like this one could slip by less avid sports fans, to be honest. It hasn't been promoted on the same level as some of Anthony Joshua's big fights, for example. So a question for you, Flynn. What has been your sense of this fight so far?
You hit the nail on the head just then. It's not been promoted on the same level as some of these, like AJ's fights and Fury's last fight. Like that fight, everyone in the world knew when and where that was going down. I just realized this week, Fury's fighting again. Even though I've been sort of seeing things online pop up, just it hasn't been anywhere near to the same extent. Now I know it's coming up. I'm hyped for it. I can't wait. I don't know. It's just, wasn't there some issue at the press conference there, or wasn't it a training session where Dillian White didn't show up? What was the story there?
Well, yeah, this is one of the things I wanted to talk about, really. Dillian White has outright refused to get involved in a lot of the promotion for this fight. Now, you can look at that a number of ways, and Frank Warren, Tyson Fury's promoter, has openly criticized him for not getting involved. He's saying he's basically in breach of contract. You have to agree to certain things once you sign up that will promote the fight to a reasonable extent, et cetera, et cetera. I haven't seen the contracts, but this is basically what he's saying. Oh, don't take it as given. Don't get me wrong, but this is the story that's out there. And we have certainly seen less of Dillian White in the lead up to this fight than you would expect to see for a World Heavyweight Championship fight. So all that being said, I think it's a very intelligent move on Dillian White's part. Because I don't know how many times I've seen it, but for Tyson Fury, the press conferences, the preamble, the lead-in is where he does some of his most effective work. He gets into people's heads. I first seen it against Vladimir Klitschko. I've seen it countless times since against Deontay Wilder, against lower down opponents like Tom Schwartz, against Otto Wallin. He wants to be getting in people's faces. Like a famous example is against Steve Cunningham in one of his breakout fights, really. His first fight in the US, fighting a cruiserweight. He gets dropped in the second round, I think. But in the pre-fight press conference, he's going in. He's like, I hope you and your trainer know magic. Like, I hope you're getting sponsors on the bottom of your boots. He's like, I'm 6'9", you're 6'1". I'm knocking you spark out. Like, it's just simple. Like, and he derives strength from that. I think Dillian White understands that. They two were in camp together years ago. I think they know what each other are like, really. And I think he's just chosen not to get involved at all. And there are practical considerations as well. He's been training in Portugal. You don't want to take a two-day trip just to do a little photo shoot in the middle of London next to Wembley. Do you know what I mean? So there are those considerations. But I do think it has hurt the promotion overall.
I think you made a solid point there. He does a lot of damage in those press conferences. Was it against Klitschko where he turned up dressed as Batman? And then someone in the crowd was a Joker. And he just made the whole thing look like a joke. And Klitschko's like a serious dude. He just made him look like a joke. I remember some of the trash talk. He's like, I know what you're about. You just do that. He just named the combo that Klitschko always does. And sure enough, he was right.
Yeah, he's like, 1-2 hold, 1-2 left hook hold. He's like, what are you going to do to me, man? He's like, I can see that shit coming. And on that same press conference, turned up as Batman. First of all, you'd be thinking, what the fuck is going on here? Second of all, he gets out of his Batman suit and he's there and he switches up his energy completely. He goes from this really jocular, jovial character to standing on his feet over Klitschko, like going mad. Like, call me a fool again. Like, do that again. He's like, it's going off now. So he plays with the emotional volume in the room. Do you know what I mean? It's very manipulative and very clever. And I think being aware of that is key. And it's a good sign that Dillian White is aware of that, because today there was like a little bit of ruckus on the stage when they had their first face off. But it was more their teams that were getting involved, like Tyson Fury's dad, John Fury.
Nerves.
I'll beat you. I'll fight you. And Dillian White was talking after. He's like, mate, you're an old man. He's like, chill out, bro. He's like, me and your son are fighting. Like, let us have our days. Like, stop getting gassed. So matter of fact, it was jokes. But in terms of the interaction between the two fighters, it was very polite today. And you could take that one way or the other. You might think that indicates that the fight's going to be shit. But for me, I think like it's all business. They're not even wasting energy cussing each other. They're just going to get right down to it. I think this could lead to quite an exciting fight. And obviously, the background to this is the eternal cock tease of the undisputed championship of the world. It's now decided that Alexander Usyk, who owns the three other belts in the heavyweight division, he's gone back into training for his rematch with Anthony Joshua. That's going to take place sometime before the end of the year. This fight is very important because we've been waiting for Fury and AJ for a long time, and there's no guarantee that fight's going to come off. And it might be Fury versus Usyk. And although it's exciting for the undisputed championship of the world, it's not what we want. It's not what I want. I want to see this rivalry come to fruition for all the marbles. So as for this fight, I think it's a fair question to ask whether Dillian White is being unfairly written off in this fight. Like, as you just mentioned, like, in the last week or so, you've just been like, oh, Fury's fighting sick. Have you seen any of Dillian White's fights? Like, now he's just like he's a peripheral character or?
This is what I wanted to ask you. I've seen Fury's last few fights. Amazingly exciting. I haven't seen any of Dillian White. So let us know what's he about. For anyone who's listening who doesn't know what he's about,
it's been a bit of a controversial issue that Dillian White has been mandatory challenger for the WBC heavyweight title of the world for nearly 4 years. And I don't know why that's been allowed to happen. There's been certain issues with, he was with Eddie Hearn for a while, and obviously AJ is his main fucking top heavyweight. So you're going to try and steer them one way or the other, like away from each other, then bring them back together later on. So there's an issue there, but in the absence of him not getting his title shot, he's put together one of the most impressive resumes in heavyweight boxing. Now, he was knocked out by AJ back in 2015. Sick fight, like absolutely sick. He was the first person to really put a dent in AJ, even if it was only briefly. And after a brief rebuilding period, Avika Bakarin, Dave Allen, Ian Lewison, he got like just cleaned them out, learning period with a new trainer, etc. Then he goes on this run. Derek Chisora, split decision win. Amazing fight. It's a banger. Like, I would advise anyone to go and watch that fight. He beats Robert Hellenius. He is of similar dimensions to Tyson Fury. He hurt Dillian White early, and then White came back into the fight and basically got the UD. Not the best fight to watch entertainment-wise, but a very good win. Then he knocks out Lucas Brown, who was undefeated at 25-0. Inactive, but a former heavyweight champion. He then beats Joseph Parker, who'd only lost to AJ up to that point. And like, they knock each other down. He then has his rematch with Derek Chisora, knocks him out in the 11th. He fights a guy called Oscar Rivas, who's an absolute tank, undefeated, 26-0. I think both of them tested positive for steds for that one. The fight still went ahead. He gets the unanimous decision there. Then he fights Marius Wack on the undercard of the AJ rematch with Andy Ruiz. He's overweight, out of training, still gets the unanimous thing. Then when it's looking like, okay, this one's the one. If you win this fight, you're going to fight for the title. He fights Alexander Povetkin, former heavyweight champion and professed stead user himself. After, I would say 4.5 rounds of probably White's most clinical performance. He gets knocked out cold, left hook to the body, left up put upstairs, bang, bang. And he's like, that was a serious knockout. But then you got to give him credit because he rematched him like 7-8 months later and knocked him out in the fourth round. Listen, Dillian White's a serious guy. He deserves to be in this spot. I think his resume stacks up against anyone in the world, anyone. But he's got a serious problem in the man that's standing opposite him, in that he would compete in any era, not just the top 10s around today. Tyson Fury is a serious problem. So, but in terms of your question, in terms of who Dillian White is and what he's about, he deserves to be here for sure.
So, follow-up question to that. How's this fight going to go down? Not who's going to win, but we're not looking at a Belal Muhammad kind of fight here, are we?
I've been thinking about this and the chess game that comes along with people's predictions. You know, there are certain narratives that develop before fights. And the one for this is Tyson Fury can box him up. He has to keep it long. He has to use his jab. He's been looking for knockouts in his last few fights under Sugar Hill Stewart, Emmanuel Stewart's nephew. And he's been getting them. He's been getting, like, against Deontay Wilder, his second performance. His performance in the second fight against Deontay Wilder, I don't think he'll ever beat that. He was perfect. The third Deontay Wilder fight is way more exciting. But Fury was just thinking, I know you've got power, but you've already landed your best shot. You couldn't knock me out. I'm going to fuck you up. And Deontay Wilder still dropped him twice, still nearly knocked him out. And Fury proved himself right. But I don't think that was him at his best. So in that respect, I think it all depends on how Fury wants to approach this fight. If he wants to stay behind a long, hard jab and stay evasive and just break him down a bit, I think Dillian White will really struggle to get anywhere near him. Now, the other narrative is if Dillian White has to do anything in this fight, it's get close and work him to the body. Once you enter a certain range with Tyson Fury, a whole different game begins. He'll start grabbing hold of you. He'll start leaning on you. He'll start moving you towards the ropes. He'll start giving you cheeky little uppercuts and hooks around the head. He knows how to use his size, his dimensions, and his know-how perfectly all the time. And I think it's quite difficult to work Tyson Fury's body. His head's really elusive. But when he starts wrestling with you on the inside and that, the referee's got no choice but to break it up. Do you know what I mean? And then he gets his distance again. And then he starts working again. It's a long night's work for Dillian White, man. Trust me.
So look, Fury's got some serious fight IQ, as we've seen. How does White's IQ stack up? Does he have the fight IQ to be able to do what you're saying?
In terms of IQ, I would take that to mean how you yourself negotiate your way through a fight. And I think it was Carl Frampton who said something like, there are times when Dillian White gets tired and then he gets wild and then he gets a bit desperate. And he does the exact opposite of what you would expect someone to do when they get tired and exhausted. Instead of going into a shell, he starts throwing bombs, man. At the end of that Joseph Parker fight, he was spent. He'd just been knocked down, got collapsed out of exhaustion. And for the last 10 seconds, he literally pinned Parker against the ropes and just held him there. The ref was like, move. He was like, nah, fuck that. I'm staying here, man. He just sort of saw the final bell. He knows how to negotiate situations. Now, if that was the battle, IQ versus IQ, I still think Tyson Fury would win. But it depends what kind of game plan they've come up with. If they've come up with a very specific game plan and Dillian White is able to execute it, obviously he's got a chance of winning. Obviously, he could land the Bishop Challenger playground one bomb. Do you know what I mean? That could happen. It's heavyweight boxing. But at the same time, if he starts getting early success, I would really back Tyson Fury to adjust to whatever he's doing. So he's not only need to have one way to attack, he needs to be prepared for the adjustment and then have a second way to go, possibly a third. But then we're talking, the rounds are getting on, you know, 8, 9, 10, then you're getting tired. Then you're still getting jabbed in your face. You're still getting leaned on. Your energy sources are depleting. You're getting hurt. I can see this. I don't think it's as simple as White gets close and wins and Fury stays away and wins. I think Fury can have the best of both worlds here, and I think he can knock him out from the outside. I can see him doing that. Like, straight long punches, bang, bang, 1-2, and White's just nowhere near him.
So, is that you calling it? Fury's got it.
I think Fury round 9, to be honest.
And is Fury round 9. You heard it here first, everyone.
Very specific. But it's a fascinating fight, and one with every heavyweight championship fight has big ramifications, but with the way the land lies now, it's serious, man. And then we've just got one more fight to go, and then we're going to get the undisputed fight, man. It's nearly here.
Here's one, just one more on the Fury and White situation. So one of the big things that got mentioned a lot was the weight difference between Fury and Wilder. And it looks like, I don't have the weights here to hand, but just seeing the two men standing together, that weight difference is a lot smaller than it was in that fight. What's the situation there? What do you know about that?
So in terms of form, let's go over their box recs now and see what they're weighing in at. So Dillian White is substantially heavier. We're talking Marius Vak, as I mentioned, out of shape there. So he was 271. Like, closer to what you'd expect Tyson Fury to be. In the first Alexander Povetkin fight, 252 and a quarter. In the second Povetkin fight, 247 and a quarter. Rivas, 259. Derek Chisora rematch, 246 and a half. He seems to be around that 250 mark, give or take a few pounds. And if we compare that to Tyson Fury, in his last fight, he was 277 against Wilder. The fight before that, the second fight with Wilder, 273. Against Otto Wallin, 254. Against Tom Schwartz, 263 and a half. Against Deontay Wilder in the first fight, 256. Recently, you've seen Tyson Fury bulk up a little bit. So now he's chilling more around 275. Whereas that's when he's in shape, big and strong. Whereas Dillian White, where he's training hard, where he's in shape, and I've seen videos of him, he looks quite lean, man. He's got like his veins popping out of his arms and that. I think the weight disparity is going to be significant. I think it would be 25, 30 pounds, and that's a lot of weight. I think I heard Steve Bunt say it's almost an unfair advantage. There's a lower limit to heavyweight. There's no upper limit, and there's no rule as to how close or how far away you have to be. I would definitely say that's an advantage for Tyson Fury, because he wears all that weight around his middle against a fella who specializes in body shots. That's like wearing a bulletproof vest, isn't it? Do you know what I mean?
And we saw him use it. Not only did he just outbox Wilder in the last fight, but we saw him wrestle him. We saw him use that as a tactic a lot, as you mentioned earlier. And it looks like it probably is going to be part of his game plan again, looking at this weight disparity.
Yeah, I would say so. I mean, Deontay Wilder bulked up significantly in their third fight in an attempt to negate that. But because that's like fresh muscle for him, and he seemed to load it all on his top half, his legs were still really skinny. He didn't look like he was used to the weight. Tyson Fury's been like fat as fuck his whole life, hasn't it, really? No, have you seen how much he balloons up? Like, he's used to carrying that weight. Him at 277 is like 100-odd pounds south from where he was at his heaviest, and he's in shape and strong and feeling good. It's a dangerous man right there, and he's proved himself to be dangerous. Like, imagine, well, it's impossible to say. We've seen him go through different stylistic phases. This latest one is certainly the most entertaining, but it's also the riskiest for him. I wouldn't rule out the possibility of Dillian White walking him onto something if Fury gets like overconfident, you know, especially that left hook. Now, Tyson Fury isn't historically susceptible to the left hook. It's more like an overhand right, which I don't think is Dillian White's strongest punch. But there's a scope there for drawing him in and landing something unexpectedly. And yeah, it's just a shame there's not more of an undercard to whet our appetite. It is just a one fight show, you know, but I think it'll be a good fight.
It sounds like it's going to be fucking brilliant. Yeah, if it's like a quarter as good as Tyson Fury's last fight, then I'm all in. Like, and you've made it. From what I'm hearing from you now, it sounds like it should be a banger. I'm well excited for it now.
And I think that's it. I think we saved the best till last, unless you've got one more thing.
Well, coming up, I just want to move a bit further on in the year. I just wanted to remind all the listeners that Sunday, May the 8th, we get WWE WrestleMania Backlash live in Providence, Rhode Island. Followed up a month later, Sunday, June the 5th, WWE Hell in a Cell, Chicago. Saturday, July 2nd, WWE Money in the Bank, Las Vegas. And then just to top off the year, everyone keep the weekend of December the 15th to the 18th free. And that's 237 days away, 23 hours, 2 minutes and 34 seconds as of me saying this right now, because it is Joe Wilder's Mr. Olympia Fitness and Performance Weekend 2020. Save the date.
Who could miss that? I'm certainly not going to. If I thought I was excited for Wilder, I'm so excited, I can't even get my words out. If I was excited for Fury and Dillian White, I mean, come on. That lineup, I mean, the UFC has got a lot to learn from WWE. That's what I'll say, man. Absolutely. Backlash, what an event, you know.
Oh, Backlash, SummerSlam, come on. Forget about it.
Forget about it. It was always the four, wasn't it? It was Royal Rumble, WrestleMania, SummerSlam, and Survivor Series. That was like, if I can liken it to tennis, that's probably like the Grand Slam.
Could you imagine if we were like a generation older, where we were at the age where we could have watched the Royal Rumble live in a pub or something? Could you imagine how hard it would go off?
Getting hard thinking about it right now, man. You know, I'm gonna make it. I'm gonna make a serious effort to keep my finger on the pulse of wrestling in the future. Just if nothing else, just to irritate Bissett, man. Just to be like, did you see that match? The choreography was absolutely outstanding, mate. Yeah, a heel turn was perfectly timed. But with that, we will say a final goodbye to everyone else, and especially to Bissett, because we have missed you here today. Although we've had a lot of fun in your absence, you'll be back to captain the ship next week, no doubt, man. I hope you're having a good time up and down the East Coast. And Flynn, it's been an absolute pleasure, man.
It's been a pleasure. Cheers, everyone, for listening. And yeah, sorry, Bissett. I think we needed you to rein us in this week.
Oh, respect, man.